I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Dr. Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
This amazing treatment came to be because of the hard work of those individuals. In the rolling group version of this, co-developed by Corey Roos, who's at Yale now, we do the sober breathing space every other session because people find it very useful in their lives and report that it's one of the more helpful informal practices.
Right. Dr. Katie Witkowitz, welcome to the
Thank you.
show. How's it going?
And
It's
in the
great.
rolling group
Thanks
version
for
of
having
this,
me back. I
co-developed
love being
by
here.
Corey Roos,
Oh, we're
we
happy to have
do
you
this
back.
sober breathing
Because
practice
as you
every
sort
other
of alluded
session
to, this
because
is
people
you're our
find it
first
very helpful and very
return
useful in their
guest.
daily lives.
And you're
Good
doing
for
so
you.
much work, so
And
much
in the rolling
impactful
group
work. It's
module,
you
which
know,
was
we could probably do
co-developed by
three or
Corey
four of
Roos and
these
Elena Stein,
to update
we do the
everyone
sober breathing
of what you've been doing,
space practice every other session
but we'll
because
start
people
with
find it
this.
very
So we really
useful in
appreciate
their
having
daily
you.
lives.
We always ask our guests to go over their training history at
And
the
in the
beginning.
rolling
You
group
have
module
done this
was
before, but I
co-developed by
guess it would
Corey
be
Roos
helpful
and Sarah
still
Vaughan and
to have a brief
Stein.
overview before we
We
jump in.
do the sober breathing
Absolutely,
space
yeah.
every
And
other
thanks again
session
for having
and
me.
because people
Love the
find it
show.
really useful in their
Regular
daily lives.
listener, love the episodes, love what you all are doing. So thanks for having me back. So my training, I had a bit of a different trajectory. I started at community college. I don't know if I mentioned that last time, but started at community college and had a phenomenal introductory to psychology class that I decided from that moment on that I wanted to be a psychology professor. So finished undergrad at State University of New York at Potsdam in psychology, went straight to grad school at the University of Montana in the PhD program in clinical psychology there. Had some bumps in the road at Montana but that's where I actually stumbled upon addiction research. So it worked out really well to go to Montana for a bit. My mentor there was Michael Hufford. My second mentor there, my first mentor didn't work out. So my second mentor at Montana was Michael Hufford, who was an addiction researcher who had studied with Arthur Stone and Saul Schiffman. So was one of the early pioneers of Palm Pilots for doing ecological momentary assessment. And we actually had a ton of Palm Pilots in our lab, which I thought was pretty amazing at the time. That technology
It was
was,
very advanced at the time, yes.
yeah, it was incredible. The green screen with the little stylus, I mean, it was something else. But that's how I got into addiction research, was just, he was the only lab that would take me at the time. And then tragically he left academia. I mean, tragically for academia, I think he's doing amazing work now. Actually just was really involved with getting over the counter Narcan available. So over the counter naloxone available as part of his harm reduction company. So he's doing great work. But anyway, so he left and then I was kind of mentorless. And I left Montana and then really got super lucky. I tell this story a lot, but I'll say it again. Just you never know what's gonna happen at an 8 a.m. poster session. Because I was at Sunday morning, 8 a.m. poster session at ABCT, the Association for Behavior and Cognitive Therapies, previously known as AABT. And this was when it was the AABT version, and met Alan Marlatt. He came to my poster and asked me about it, asked me about the research I was doing. It was actually my master's thesis. And then he asked me what I was doing next. And I think he assumed that question was like, what's my dissertation topic or something? But my answer, which was completely honest, was actually I'm dropping out of grad school and I have no idea what I'm going to do next. And so, that's when he invited me to have me work with him at the University of Washington. And so I applied to the University of Washington to work with him and finished my PhD there in clinical psych. Almost 20 years ago. So that's and then went straight into the job market. So I didn't do a postdoc, regrettably. I didn't do a postdoc.
Did you do your internship at UW?
Yep. I
Yeah,
finished my
okay.
internship at University of Washington too. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a remarkable story. I mean, I think there are many, many ways to get to the same destination, but this one stands out to me. Jim actually said he met you at, I think, at this ABCT, and he's also out there telling the story about 8 a.m. poster sessions, because he told me it's just a remarkable story to have met especially such an incredible mentor in person, and to sort of stumble into that. It's remarkable.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And yeah, Jim was there. I remember meeting Jim at that meeting too. We were both grad students at the time. I think he might have come to my poster as well. I don't specifically remember him as much as I remember Alan, but
Sure.
but now that I know
Makes
Jim much
sense.
better, I would absolutely have put that moment in my memory, committed that to memory as well. But yeah, no, it's the world is as small and wild, and you never know what's going to happen. So yeah, it's just openness to the experience of the universe, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's it. And now that we've done this, we've been doing this for a little while. This we're getting up close to 50 episodes or so pretty soon here. And we hear a lot of stories because we do this every time. And what the pattern that stands out to me is just like how much, like happenstance and luck and kind of magic in the process kind of just happens. Stacey Daughters, for instance, last time was talking about very similar thing. I went to community college too, and it was one of the best educational experiences I ever had, and wouldn't be here without it. And so shout out community college, and shout out to just random events in the universe, 8 a.m. poster sessions at ABCT, which is like the last bastion of research presentation at ABCT, is that Sunday morning 8 a.m. session. It's just like the when you get hit with that, you're like, damn, right? But hey,
Yeah.
changed the entire field of addiction because that meeting took place and you had a poster at it, given just how impactful your work has been in the field. And your collaboration with Alan Marlatt over the years has really just moved the needle. And so real true magic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say, I think meeting Alan at that poster session certainly overshadowed anything that came before it. But I suspect I was very disappointed to get that slot.
Oh, sure.
When you find out when your presentation's going to be, and then it's at the Sunday 8 a.m. last day of the conference session, like all of us are always bummed out. We think there's going to be no one at the session, and
Yeah,
it's
people
just
flying out already, and
yeah, exactly. And
exactly.
so I imagine that I was pretty bummed about that draw. But who knows?
Who knows?
So
Exactly.
I maybe don't be so bummed out when you get that bad draw, because
Right.
you never know what could happen next.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's a good
Seriously.
reminder to take even the smallest opportunities like seriously. Because yeah, the fortune, I guess, could be on the other side.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so, frankly, to have the courage to just be radically genuine in those moments and have conversations with people in ways that are, aimed at making a change and making a difference, and that's how it all came to life there, right? Because had you just been like, oh, I don't know, guess next steps would be insert, some kind of academic next step related to that project, versus like, hey, you know what, I'm actually thinking about making a radical life change, and poof, there it goes. And so there's all these tiny little opportunities all around us all the time that if we're not paying attention, we might miss. And I think this is a really important reminder of that, which I think really also lends itself to the topic of the day, which is, we could talk about, a host of different lines of research that you have. But today we really wanted to talk about mindfulness-based relapse prevention, and being mindful in the moment, as you described there, I think really, lends itself to the topic of the day. And so, if it's all right, maybe we could start a discussion about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And if it wasn't for Alan, there would be no mindfulness-based relapse prevention. So it really
Precisely.
starts with that moment, even though at the time, that's not the work I was doing, but ultimately that's, I would say, of the work I did in Alan's lab, that's had the most impact and continues to do so.
Maybe we could just start off with talking a little bit about, an overview of the concept of relapse or return to use, and what its meaning has kind of in the trajectory of a substance use disorder and treatment and recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for asking that question. And really, I have to give a bit of a history lesson of Alan's work, because he really coined the term relapse prevention in the late 1970s, early 80s.
and obviously published a book with Judith Gordon in 1985 on the term. So he the term relapse prevention really comes from Alan and his initial work in studying people who went through treatment for predominantly alcohol use disorder. And you know, at the time, and I think it's really interesting to think about this, but at the time, relapse prevention as a term was incredibly radical. Like just using that term, and it was radical for reasons that are different from how I see it as kind of maybe unwanted and radical today, which we can get to. But it was very radical at the time because every treatment was so abstinence focused. Abstinence was the only way, absolutely, that you should not even talk about returning to use, because even talking about it gives permission. And so Alan at the time was a pioneer for wanting to talk about relapse, for wanting to talk about the possibility that people would return to use after treatment, and to take it one step further, to provide skills for them to get back on track if they did have a return to use. And so at the time, the treatment landscape was very averse to even thinking about the possibility of returning to use because it gave permission to use after treatment. And so Alan was a pioneer for really seeing that, wait a minute, no, like he's a radical behaviorist, right? And he saw the behavior happening. He saw that people were returning to use. And so really wanted to, I mean, he did a whole line of research wanting to understand that process of how people return to use. But also then also developed a treatment to help prevent that from happening. And was radical for it at the time.
Well, and it's I think it's a marker of impact to hear something like that was radical and that now is so almost obvious that we're shocked to hear that it was radical. You know, he and in the work of many other people, yourself included, have worked tirelessly for you know since the 70s to in different capacities to normalize that and to sort of bring that into into the light.
Yeah, absolutely. And he did a lot of work, the earliest work on really trying to understand return to use and what were the predictors of return to use, and did the seminal work on quote unquote relapse risk factors, and proposed the cognitive behavioral model of relapse, which we then updated to have some more dynamic and ecological features, and I think, ultimately, it is pretty obvious today that, of course, we should address, people slipping up in treatment or not achieving their goals. But at the time, it was very much radical and not received well in the treatment community, from my understanding, from the stories he tells.
I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things, you know, it's a piece of advice I got over the years that really stands out to me. A friend and colleague named Tyler Ray once told me he strives to do work where when you describe it to somebody else, they're like, wait, nobody's done that? We should definitely figure what's going on out with that, you know, like, and so, you know, the idea that like, oh, what predicts when people return to use after treatment? Nobody's really looked into that. We should probably check it out, right? And then those are like end up being these really, you know, especially this one, just like an inflection point in, you know, the entire field and broadly, right? And now things like relapse prevention are so kind of core to the treatment landscape and the discussion around these issues, you know, that it often kind of gets like skipped over in training a lot of times, like, oh, you should just kind of think about that and have a plan for it and such. And so, you know, I wonder if it would be all right just for our listeners who might not know, maybe if we could just talk a little bit about what some of the predictors are of return to use that kind of set in motion the model that you discussed kind of working over over the years between you and Alan.
And I want to the Tyler Ray thing is interesting, sidebar, and I was going to say something else that is I try to give talks where I think I'm going to get thrown tomato, like people are going to throw tomatoes at me, you know, like, and I feel like that was Alan back in the day.
I'm
And for
sure.
me, it's like every time I give a talk about non-abstinent recovery, like I go in a little bit
Oh,
scared
ooh, right.
and hoping there's no produce because
Yes,
like,
exactly.
yeah. But anyways,
Right. Yeah.
okay.
The Zoom era, right? Kept
Yes,
saved you from
luckily
the
saved you. Yes,
tomatoes.
exactly. There should be a future for that, probably.
I'll go back to answer your question. Yes, the relapse risk factors that have been identified really consistently over the years, and I'll just give a shout out to Wilco Sliedrecht, who's a P, who was a PhD student, now has his PhD, but I was a support her a supporter or promoter of his dissertation in the Netherlands, and so he just published a systematic review to update this model. But generally, you know, across the board, negative affect is a huge one, but also often ignored is positive affect. And so actually, if there is a place I think that we need to be doing better as a field, it is to consider positive emotionality and positive affect as a potential trigger for returning to use. And you know, urgency works both ways. There's positive urgency and negative urgency. So I think that's a, you know, negative emotionality, negative mood has long been described as one of the most prominent predictors of returning to use. And in Alan's earliest work, that stood out as number one, negative emotional states. So, but again, I think we're ignoring positive emotional states, positive affect, celebratory reasons that people might get caught might get caught off guard, actually. Another big one has always been physiological states, you know, craving, withdrawal, really wanting, seeking relief from whatever is happening. And so I really put that all into one big bucket of, and this really gets to the mindfulness-based treatment, but really wanting to not experience what's currently happening. So that could be boredom, that could be depression, that could be anxiety, anger. But really seeking relief. And in Alan's initial model, that was really all like physiological and withdrawal. But I would make that a little bit, that group of predictors a little bit broader to include any sort of desire to you know, relieve from what is currently happening. Because boredom is another factor that I think has been generally ignored in the field.
Underappreciated, yeah.
Way underappreciated, yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. And clinically, right? So
Oh,
I
yeah.
didn't mention that I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and I don't practice currently in the, you know, in a private way, but I do a lot of supervision and still have my toe in that water, and boredom often comes up as a reason
Yeah.
that people
Oh, yeah.
use. Yep. And then, you know, there less support, but definitely a factor for many people is social aspects and social pressure to use, or you know, kind of not wanting to disrupt a social process or interfere with a interper so generally interpersonal factors, I would say, going both directions. So either, you know, a person, another person is pressuring to you to use, or another person is condemning you or like making you feel a lot of shame or stigma or depression, and so you're kind of using in response to that other person's interaction, and recognizing that generally we are social creatures, and so there's, you know, in a lot of return to use situations, there is a social environment
Element,
factor.
yeah.
And you know, I would say those are kind of the big ones. And then you know, we've done recent work, and you had Jeff Boisano on recently, just this last couple of episodes
Yeah.
ago, and you know, Jeff's done great work on chronic pain, as well as Des Moskal and others, Joe Dutry and Emily Zale and Mark Ilgen. And there's not that many of us in doing the intersection of alcohol and pain, but there are some of us. And you know, so physical pain and its manifestations, and again, kind of wanting to relieve. So that goes back to that bigger second grouping of just wanting to relieve current states. And then, you know, going back to the positive affect, there is this reward seeking
aspect as well. And so wanting to experience reward, wanting to feel good. I think as clinical psychologists, we generally over-pathologize a little bit, and we don't ever consider that maybe our patients actually feel good when they're using substances and they want to feel good.
Yeah.
And
Yes.
like, it is, can that be okay? Like, can we allow that to be okay as a field and depathologize and destigmatize the fact that drugs serve a purpose in our society? They always have. And oftentimes they make people feel good. And I don't think we do a service to our patients by ignoring that factor or pretending that it doesn't exist. And similarly to Alan, back in the late 70s, early 80s, not pretending that people were going to return to use. I think it's really important for all of us to not pretend that people might return to use because they want to use, because that's what they want to do in the moment, because it makes them feel good or fulfilled, or they like the taste, or it provides connection. And this will we'll talk about this this notion of what we actually are seeking when we talk about the mindfulness-based treatment, because I think a lot of people drink for very wholesome reasons. It doesn't always get them what they want, but there's this level of very wholesome reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an important point. That's really an important point that, I think Matt Field talked a little about this on an episode we had here. And, I think people like Adam Leventhal has written about this, about the idea that, these things, oftentimes we live in societies and under conditions where, substance use represents a very reliable, positive mood boost, and, I think the lack of consideration around positive emotion and boredom, I think, is an important point you've made here. And maybe I'm biased, but much of my work really focuses on this idea. We're doing a bunch of work right now around boredom and about low positive emotion, so that the absence of positive emotion, how substance use really gives people reliable access to swift changes in positive emotion, which ends up being a fairly reliable predictor across groups and things. And so this is, I think, maybe we need to tend to that a little bit more, and versus being like, you should avoid this stuff, like understand the function that it serves for people, I think, is really the key here. And really understand what it is that they're looking for and how, substance use might really represent this like obvious, reliable, and accessible a medium by which to do these things that most people are looking for in their life, myself included, right? And so whether or not you use substances, I think you can kind of identify with that process. And so I think that really helps us to humanize the person and to really understand the positions in which they find themselves, which I think helps us to match them to the appropriate solutions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think if you're, if you're finding yourself like, not you particular, but if people in the field are finding themselves like judging that substance use, like that's on the person doing the judging, that
Yes.
and to let go of that moral, we do have this very still persistent morality based, approach to substance use that I just think is harming a lot of people,
Oh
and
yes.
is stigmatizing and is perpetuating a war on drugs, frankly,
Yes. That's a great
that
point.
we know is ineffective.
I was just, lots of reactions to this conversations, but the one that sort of was standing out to me was this is where I think the argument for moralization, I think there's a lot of reasons not to make it, but in the end, it just doesn't work to
Yes.
say, well, this is wrong, and therefore you shouldn't do it. It totally ignores the reason for why it's being done, and
Yes.
it maybe forces someone to stop using, but then puts them right back in their environment where they have the same needs, the same wants,
Yeah.
and no new solutions to solve all of those problems. And if we want, if we see drug use, alcohol use as functional, as serving some sort of function, then I think part of what treatment is, right, is to identify what those functions are and give them alternatives, right, to serve those
Yes.
functions.
Absolutely. Yes. No, 100%. And I love your work in this area, Sam, because I really think as a field, we've done such a disservice by focusing solely on consumption and eliminating or in some respects, in some programs, reducing consumption and not at all on what replaces it.
Yes. Yeah.
What am I going to do instead that's going to still make me feel good or still make me feel connected or still make me not feel bad?
Yeah.
And
Yes. Yeah.
that is largely not, I mean, some treatments do a great job of that, including, the ones that you both have worked on, but it's definitely something I think that is not as mainstream in the broader treatment landscape and really needs to be.
Yeah, and all of those things you mentioned are just normal human needs. To want to feel good is the most human thing that exists, you
And to
know?
not
Yes.
want to feel bad.
Exactly.
Right, like
Perhaps even more human that.
exactly,
Yeah.
right. And so to not appreciate that is to remove a person's humanity, right? And I think that's one of the beautiful things about, relapse prevention as a model more broadly, which was, they appreciated, kind of some of the functions, but also like really let's talk about skills to fill in these, gaps. Once you were if you're if you're going to remove substance use from the equation, something must replace it to balance it out, right? And those are skills. And I think that's one of the real elegant things about, even more the traditional relapse prevention models, like kind of organization around like understanding high-risk situations and the skills associated with them. And then, these kind of covert determinants of use, which have just different risk windows, is the kind of way I like to think about it, right? Like high-risk situations are where it kind of abruptly and has a time-limited risk window that I'm going to need to learn how to deal with. Like, I got to go to my brother's wedding, right? And everybody's going to be drinking, and I'm concerned about trying to not drink in that space. And how am I going to deal with that? Maybe I'll be experiencing negative affect. Maybe I'll be experiencing positive emotion. Maybe I'm going to be having internal monologue that says that people are thinking I'm unusual for un not drinking, right? I'll probably be experiencing craving. There's a whole host of all of those predictors of, return to use are all kind of alive and well in this space. But once you exit it, a bunch of it you leave behind, some of your internal states come with you, right? And so trying to learning how to deal with that, whereas like more of a covert stuff, right, or things that kind of build over time, right, like lifestyle imbalance, where I'm really trying to focus on building this different life in recovery, and I'm not maybe tending to the positive emotional needs that I have, and it gets out of whack, and the next thing I know, I presented with an opportunity and, I didn't even realize before I kind of reflexively engaged in it. And so I think that was one of the real elegant things I think about the model here is it really helps us to think about not only what predicts it, but like what context it's going to happen in and how to build out skills around it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing this up, but also I'm going to totally transition us to talking about mindfulness-based relapse prevention because I think this is also where relapse prevention falls apart. And
Agreed.
that's what I observed in doing relapse prevention groups. And so, I think the issue with relapse prevention and other skills-based training programs, cognitive behavior therapy, coping skills training programs, is that they really focus on training people for like these high-risk situations and what are your relapse risk factors and what are you going to do in this situation and that situation and how are you going to handle it? And that's all well and good and that's great. And a piece of that is really important. And in my experience of leading relapse prevention groups, I think two things would come up clinically with patients that really showed the failures of or the fault points, not the failures, but the fault points or potential breakpoints of that model. And one is, having a client once who I was doing relapse prevention with, and she had like a big, thing coming up, like the brother's wedding that you used in your example. And so we spent an entire session just planning for that event and all the things she was going to do to not use and all the ways she was going to have alternative beverages, what she was going to do when she felt X, Y, and Z, really doing a very solid functional analysis of that particular event and worked it all out. And she was very confident, left the session 10 out of 10 self-efficacy to not drink because her goal was not drinking. to not drink at that event. So she comes back the next week, devastated. She had returned to drinking that week. Not at the event. Nope, she did great at that, but she lost her job.
Oh,
wow.
So it was such a stark reminder of, like, we can do so much in this treatment to help people plan for events that they know that are going to happen. But what happens when something comes up, as it does, because life is life, that you don't plan for?
Yep.
And you don't have the skills for. And yeah. So what about a treatment that just changes how you live?
Yes.
And how you experience life as a human. And so that's the first example. And then I'll transition to how this all relates to mindfulness-based relapse prevention. The second one was just one of the most crushing moments of my training and in my early life as a clinical psychologist. And actually, I think I had graduated at this point, or maybe I was on internship or just post-internship. So it was very near the end of my training, you know, and I was running relapse prevention groups as part of our clinical trial. So yeah, it would have been post-internship. So I would have been a fully fledged PhD clinical psychologist at this point and running relapse prevention groups. And we were in session 7 of an 8-week relapse prevention group. And one of the clients said, you know, this has been really, we were kind of reflecting on the group and next steps and what did they need for week 8, because we had only one session left. And one of the clients said, you know, you've given us so many different skills and so many opportunities to practice those skills. And I feel really confident in my ability to use these skills in different settings. And I, you know, I've practiced them and that this has all been super helpful. And what do I do when I don't want to use the skills? What do I do when I'm in a situation where I don't want to use your skills and I want to use? What happens then? And from a relapse prevention model perspective, I mean, other than doing some kind of functional analysis around when would that come up and what would that look like for you and what would be the precipitating factors that would lead you to not want to use the skill, I felt a bit at a loss of how to respond in that moment to this bigger kind of motivate, and it's a motivational piece. And I know I'm following the great Bill Miller in this episode. And so I'll give a shout out to how important motivational interviewing is for addressing the want to change piece. But I think there's also something much deeper in that, in his comment. And it was a much deeper human kind of need to want to engage in a behavior and really wanting to do it. And so I think that's where, you know, relapse prevention in some ways falls short of helping people. And so you know, mindfulness-based relapse prevention, I think I have seen it be really valuable in those two kind of settings, but also in a lot of other settings that we can talk about.
It's one of those moments, I think, that is so human. And both of these, I think, are so human. But where I can imagine as a therapist, you're just like, I don't know, my reaction is, well, like, that's sort of your right, you know, yeah. And I'm really curious to see how this led to sort of the creation and what's the solution you found.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, that did not at all lead to mindfulness-based relapse prevention. What it led to, ironically, was what it led to more so than anything was my commitment to investing more of my energy into mindfulness-based relapse prevention. Because at the time, and I'll give you the backstory. I'll just finish this thought and then I'll give you the backstory of how mindfulness-based relapse prevention did come to be. But at the time of this event, of that group, of that week 7 of me running relapse prevention groups, we had, you know, a piece of Alan's lab was really still focused on relapse and predicting relapse and relapse prevention. And I was team relapse prevention in the Marlatt lab. And then another group of folks in the Marlatt lab were developing and testing mindfulness-based relapse prevention. So at the time the program was being developed, Sarah Bowen was leading that effort, a graduate student at the time, and Neha Chawla, Neharika Chawla, also a graduate student at the time, were really leading the effort of developing mindfulness-based relapse prevention, and with also input from Mary Larimer and Brian Ostafin and Seema Clifford-Seffi, Susan Collins, Michelle Garner was there. Of course, Alan Marlett was contributing. So there was this whole other group that was developing mindfulness-based relapse prevention. Joel Groh as well, and then Sarah Bowen and Neha Chawla and Joel Groh have just released the second edition of the Clinician's Guide. And really, you know, I think so much of this program, I just have to give credit to Sarah Bowen for her brilliance in developing this program, and training so many people, and really carrying on this work and giving us the opportunity to study it and to deliver it clinically. And so we, you know, we wrote a grant to pin them up against each other. And I was team relapse prevention. I was not team MBRP, I'll call it. Mindfulness-based relapse prevention at the time. So that event, like, I totally switched teams from that point going forward, because I just really realized where relapse prevention was falling apart and where mindfulness-based relapse prevention filled that void. But yeah, so it's such a great story how mindfulness-based relapse prevention came to be, and I'll do the Cliff Notes version since we don't have a ton of time. But basically, Alan in the 70s had developed hypertension and went to his doctor, and his doctor wanted to put him on medication for hypertension. And Alan didn't want to go on medication. So he said, "Is there anything else I can do?" And the doctor recommended transcendental meditation. And so that's when Alan started his own personal mindfulness practice. And at the time, he thought about, you know, using it as a treatment for drinking, even back then, and had a graduate student in the lab who was interested in that as well. So they did an initial test of meditation for college student drinking. And they did an initial clinical trial of like a precursor to basics, or, you know, basically a brief intervention for college student drinking. An exercise intervention and meditation, and basically found they were all effective. But he was given feedback at the time that, you know, meditation in the 70s and early 80s was pretty froofy stuff. Like, it was, you know, not mainstream science like it is today. And so was given, you know, kind of advice to, if he wanted to get tenure and promoted at University of Washington, that was not a good line of research for him to follow up. So flash forward to the late 1990s, and he had continued his meditation practice, his personal meditation practice throughout that time. Flash forward to the late 1990s, and there was a minimal security prison in Seattle that wanted to do Vipassana meditation, which is a tradition, a Buddhist tradition of meditation. Vipassana is the Pali term for insight, so insight meditation, essentially. And they wanted to do a Vipassana meditation course as part of the prison. One of the people who worked at the prison had done Vipassana courses and really wanted to try it as a way of helping people in this minimal security prison. So he convinced the prison to do it, but then one of the people who was running the prison said, you know, "I think we really should collect data on this if we're gonna do this, that we should evaluate it," which was brilliant, right? Like, but I'm gonna need to show that this works to convince the county to keep giving us money, or convince the state to keep giving us money for this facility. So they reached out to Alan because he was a researcher at the University of Washington, and this was a minimal security prison in Seattle. He had this kind of, he was known in the meditation community. He was part of the Buddhist meditation community in Seattle. And so they reached out to him, and he wrote an R21, and it was funded, and to study this prison. It was the first ever Vipassana meditation course in the United States in a prison. They were done in India for decades before this, but it was the first one in the US.
And so that grant started in 2000, and I started in the lab in 2001. And so part of my initial role in the lab was working on that study, that was Vipassana meditation for prisoners, and really looking at alcohol and drug use outcomes, as well as recidivism. And so just a bit on Vipassana meditation, it's a 10-day course, silent meditation course. You meditate from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., vegetarian meals, completely silent other than conversations with the teachers. And there's Dharma talks, which are kind of connecting the process of meditation to the Buddhist teachings in the evenings. And so that provides some guidance on, like, why are you attending to your breath for 10 hours a day? What's the point of that? And so so that's what they did, and they did it in the prison. It was really challenging to do that, and to do the research as well. We could not obviously randomize participants to require them to do a 10-day Vipassana course. So we recruited, tried to recruit everyone who agreed to participate in the meditation course, and then oversampled the control group with the goal of kind of matching people in the control group and the Vipassana group for outcomes analysis. We ended up not needing to do any sort of matching procedure because the groups were perfectly well matched at baseline to begin with. There were no predictors of who went into the course and who didn't. And the outcomes were phenomenal, just really amazing reductions in post-release drinking, post-release smoking, post-release other drug use, and more so, really amazing outcomes on mental health, and lower depression, lower anxiety, lower anger. And we didn't collect the recidivism data, but the prison did, and there was also lower recidivism in the Vipassana group. So we were super excited about those findings, as you would be, and so really wanted to follow it up with a larger study that would be actually non-prison based, like a community study of Vipassana meditation, and ultimately submitted the same grant, three, four times. I think it was four. Back then, you could submit three. So I think it must have gone in at least three or four times. You could submit three, and then the idea was dead. But I think we went like three times to NIAAA, and then two times to NIDA,
Wow.
to try and R21 again, because it was going to be, switching to kind of a community perspective. And all, every time we submitted the grant, same feedback came back. The a lot of concerns about Vipassana meditation, opportunities for medical concerns, detox issues. You're going to do this at like a retreat center. Questions about randomization, all sorts of questions, but a lot of just, I think at the time, this is again the early 2000s when mindfulness isn't on the cover of Time magazine and featured on CNN. So there was
Right.
just a lot of reluctance to have this Vipassana meditation thing. So we were working, it was Sarah Bowen and I, and another colleague, Tiara Dilworth. We were working on and Mary Larimer was there working on the next iteration of this grant. And it was about 2 in the morning. And we were trying to figure out what to do because we weren't going to get this funded as Vipassana meditation. That was clear. And, we were pulling this all-nighter to try to get this grant done. And, I think I said, what if we call it mindfulness-based relapse prevention? Let's take, at that point, mindfulness-based stress reduction had been published, and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was gaining in attention and credibility. And so I said, why don't we just, take the same model as mindfulness-based stress reduction, the same model as mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and call it mindfulness-based relapse prevention, but bring in, these same practices that we think are so valuable for people, and not call it, not do a Vipassana study, do a mindfulness-based relapse prevention study. So that's what we did. We got funded the first round, the first submission, for an R21.
Marketing, right?
It was just marketing. But yeah, it's one of those things where that's where it came from. And then we got funded, and so then we got the opportunity to develop the treatment. And really,
Wow.
really patterned it a lot after mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And in fact, Zindel Siegel and Jon Kabat-Zinn were consultants on our initial grant in our initial development, you know, program development study. And I'll just add that that R34 mechanism didn't exist back then. So if you were doing treatment development work back in the day, you really applied for an R21, which was, you know, it's hard to do treatment development and a clinical trial on a 2-year grant. But we were able to do that, and so came, you know, developed the treatment, had good data from that initial study, and then got an R01 to do a larger RCT, randomized clinical trial. So that's the origin story of mindfulness-based relapse prevention.
Wow, that I mean it's we talked a little bit, I think, about happenstance and serendipity. There was some of that in there, and there was also just sort of I guess I'll use ACT language, some psychological flexibility, using different language. Although, you know, it sort of does bring up in my mind, I just had this thought, like, it's interesting because I think there's a lot of criticism about mindfulness as sort of taking from West, you know, Eastern cultures. What occurs to me here that you were very, very intentionally trying to give this the Eastern name, and it was rejected and rejected. Which is sort of, I don't know, strikes me as probably something, you know, something systemic there, that probably needs to change.
I agree completely, and I would say absolutely. I think the Vipassana version of this would be far more effective and far more powerful for people. And it's really a shame that we don't, you know, that we don't get to test that as the treatment of interest. And someday maybe review groups will be more. I mean, at the time there wasn't the, you know, there wasn't an entire institute of the National Institutes of Health on complementary and integrative approaches like meditation-based approaches. But yeah, no, absolutely. We were not trying to take from Eastern philosophy and make it westernized. We were trying to do the Eastern version of this. And the West would not accept that. So we turned it, we secularized it, we westernized it. And in doing so, I think we might have watered it down a little, but it's still highly effective for a lot of people. And so if we, you know, if that's what it takes to get this treatment out there, then, you know, I think ultimately functionally it holds on to it. And we really have tried to make it hold on to some of those traditions. So anyone who studies it in our lab or in Sarah Bowen's lab, you practice, you know, you practice insight meditation yourself, you practice Vipassana meditation yourself, you go on retreat yourself. It really still from a research, you know, research perspective, we're really embodying those traditions, even if the treatment has been secularized and westernized.
Yeah, well, and giving adequate, I think, shout out to it. I think as you go, it's very clear that you've been, that's been the focus, right? Is giving credit where credit's due. I wonder if you'd be willing, Katie, to walk us through a little bit about sort of the tenets of as it stands, what the treatment is, but also differences, because in it sounds like in name they're fairly similar, but in practice they're fairly different.
Entirely different. I would say I always describe it as like big MB, tiny RP. So it is really mindfulness-based intervention, and I think our relapse prevention's in there to the extent that it has a frame around reactivity and reducing return to use to some extent. But really, it's big mindfulness-based intervention. So really, what we do is in every session, there's a lot of different versions of it now, but the general frame is 8 weeks group treatment, 1 hour to 2 hour sessions. It's been closed cohort and it tested, but we're testing it as rolling group, open cohort, and it's been successful in that. And that's basically all we do now is open group, rolling group,
Much easier
much
to
easier.
recruit.
And I don't see a huge loss. And if anything, we have found there's some benefits of rolling group because then you get people who are returning who start talking about like the ways it's been useful in their life. And so it's not me as the facilitator
telling the group members like how this is going to be useful for you. It's people returning to help teach
Right.
the skills and help talk about how how they use those skills in their daily life. So yeah, every session is kind of the same in a way. What I love about the treatment most is it's actually pretty simple. The basic idea is that we're gonna walk you through meditation practices, and in all of those practices they have the same core idea, which is we're gonna focus our awareness on something, and then we're gonna look at what the human mind and heart and energy does when you look at something, when you try to intentionally focus your awareness on the breath or on the body or on a piece of food in your that you're eating. We're going to do that. We're going to focus our awareness, and we're going to, bring some intentionality to focusing our awareness on something. But then we're also going to look at what the mind does when we're focusing on that thing. And that's really the piece that's I think the most interesting, because humans do what humans do, and our minds do what they do. Our heart beats, and our lungs breathe, and our mind thinks, and it does things. And so we start to look at that, and we start to just pay attention to it. And it, is that familiar? What the mind is doing right now, is that familiar or is that different? How does this relate to your way of moving through the world? How does this relate to maybe patterns of reactivity that you don't find very useful for you? How does this relate to times in your life when you are feeling good and wholesome? And so that, each session is just a different focus of awareness, body, mind, breath. But then we also, so that's one piece of it, but then we also introduce and basically exposure and response prevention, where we do practices where we bring craving and urges and negative emotionality into the session. And then we do the same thing, and we give it that same level of awareness of really focusing in on those urges and the craving, and what does that feel like, and what does your mind do with it? Where do you go with that? What happens when you sit with these negative emotions? And in doing so, we're really training people to sit with whatever is happening, and to sit with distress, and to or to sit with positive mood, or to sit with pain, or to sit with the terrible story that's been replaying in their head for years and years and years, and to look at it and to not run away from it, and to not have an adversarial relationship with it, but to welcome it in, and to be open to this experience, and just knowing that this is just what your mind does. This is human. This is what happens. And so we do that in these kind of formal practices. We also do a lot of training and informal practices of how do you bring this into your daily life? And so the most popular practice is the sober breathing space, which is a very brief breathing space where people stop whatever they're doing. So that's the S. They observe what's going on in the body, the emotions, the sensations, the mind. What is the quality of the mind? Is it fast? Is it slow? And then bring awareness even. I use like this with my hands. I'm making a shortening, or we also use an hourglass as an image for this, that you kind of narrow your attention to just the breath and breathing. So you're just bringing attention to breath, grounding awareness in the breath. The breath is very can be very, very grounding. It's always with us, and it's a folk it can be a really strong focus of attention. So grounding awareness in the breath, taking a few breaths, as many breaths as you need, and then expanding back out into the sensations, the emotions. How is the body feeling now after taking some time to breathe and be aware? And then ultimately the R is responding mindfully. So that's the sober breathing space, and we teach that throughout. And in the Rolling Group Manual, which was co-developed by Corey Roos and Sarah Bowen and Elaine Stein, we do the sober breathing space every other session, and because people find it really useful in their daily lives. And so it's kind of mindfulness in daily life. We also do urge surfing, and just general awareness of daily experience. And then we also do some other practices, I think, that get back to some of the things we were talking about earlier in the discussion. One practice we do is a practice where we look at substance use and why we engage in substance use and or engage in an activity that maybe is causing us problems right now, but we do this thing, you know, and oftentimes like it doesn't have to be even substance use. It could be, you know, looking at your phone 20 times a day, or it could be, you know, checking social media or whatever it is that this thing we do that we do it a lot, you know, and we don't
It just
necessarily
sort of
love it.
happens.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like some reactivity component to it that we do this thing and we don't really love it, but like, why do we do it? And when you look at the reasons of, you know, why people turn to substances or turn to their phone or turn to social media, it's almost always really wholesome reasons. There's like, you know, wanting to feel better, wanting to get away, wanting to feel connection, wanting to take a break, wanting to get relief, wanting to feel differently, wanting to not be bored. It's these very wholesome human needs. So we take a look at that and we depathologize it and we acknowledge the humanity, the common humanity of engaging in these activities. And then we also ask the question of what do you actually get? You know, when you really pay attention, what do you actually get? And it's like almost always the opposite of what you were seeking that you actually get from it. And so it's really, I think, a powerful practice for just highlighting how the things we do are, you know, oftentimes really driven by human needs. And but maybe we can take a look at it, and then maybe we can look at what are other ways of getting those needs met, or you know, use it as a signal to look for other ways to get those needs met if that's what you want in the moment is to feel connection. How are, you know, I want to feel connection. Okay, that's what I want. I don't necessarily want to drink. I don't necessarily want to be on social media. What I want to feel is connection. And so just labeling it and being aware that that's what's driving it is this very human need.
Well, like just thinking through the comparison between relapse prevention and then mindfulness-based relapse prevention, it feels almost like you teach someone or if you give someone a fish, they have a fish, right? But if you teach someone to fish, they can fish for life, because the idea being, in relapse prevention, you're sort of identifying all of the things that might come up and trying to prep them for those situations. And in this, you're sort of saying, like, learn how to notice in the moment, in every moment, what's going on, and to ask yourself the question, what do I want right now? Who do I want to be? And they can take that into any moment they experience.
Exactly. And it doesn't become contextual to the particular high-risk situation. And I think it has all these ancillary benefits of also just giving people, you know, an opportunity to pause, an opportunity and permission to pause, to really be, you know, experiencing their world in a way that's less reactive, and that we're, you know, that we actually do have space and an option, you know, to not believe everything that we think and to not let our minds drive the bus, that we get to drive the bus and our mind gets to come around along for that ride, but that it's us who's ultimately getting to choose and you know, entering choice. And then the other piece of it, and I think this is where relapse prevention and CBT also don't do as much as they could, is that the first noble truth is life is suffering. And as humans, especially I'll say, especially in the United States, but in other Western places, there's a real focus on not having suffering, right? And like a pain control agenda, a not experiencing depression agenda, you know, of fixing and changing things to not experience suffering versus acceptance that there is suffering and I'm going to experience and I can sit with it. And sometimes sitting with the suffering actually reduces suffering and also prevents us from engaging in behaviors that might actually exacerbate suffering. And so that's the other piece of this that I think is very different from relapse prevention is the acknowledgement that we're going to experience distress. We're not going to give you skills to not
experience distress.
Right.
Because we can't
Right.
do that. We can't,
Yeah.
I can't do that. You're going to experience pain. You're going to experience heartache. You're going to experience distress.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you ways of sitting with that and maybe not engaging in reactive behaviors that are going to cause more distress.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much everything worth doing comes with things that are that feel good and things that feel bad. It's brave, it's kind of Brave New World, right? Instead of choosing this the society that's all about feeling good, it's sort of rejecting that and saying like, well, part of life to sort of understand and feel the whole spectrum of what it is to be a human. Like that is what that's what living is. Yeah.
And I'll just say on that too, the other exercise that I always find really valuable is this exercise where we just list what we do in a day. And you all could do this outside of this recording, but you list all your activities in the day. Just make a list, a log of all the things you do. And then after each thing, you're next to each thing, you write an N if it's nourishing and a D if it's depleting. And nine times out of 10, like everyone has a lot of things that are ND that are like, well, it can be nourishing or it can
Yeah.
be depleting. And it's like, oh, well, isn't that interesting? How could this one activity have both of those
Be
qualities?
both.
And nine times out of 10, it's because, well, it's how I show
Wow.
up for it, right? And I always use the example of walking my dog. Like, let's say I'm walking my dog, it's raining outside, right? I can show up to that and be really excited just to be spending time with my dog outside in nature. My
Yeah.
dog's having a great time. Maybe I get to splash in a mud puddle. Like I could show up to it in a way that's super nourishing, or I could be like, oh my God, it's raining. I just want to be going to work right now and I'm already late and I'm getting all wet and this is terrible and I hate this. Like I have a choice of how I'm going to show up.
Yeah.
And so that practice is, I think, really, I think, shines a light on the difference because in doing that practice, we're not saying like, don't have D's and fill your life with N's. We're saying that what you do every single day can be N or D. And some things are just depleting and they're just depleting, but
Yeah.
how
Certainly.
you show up for them also can make them even more depleting, right?
Right. Yeah.
So if I mean, we all have a ton of Zoom meetings these days. If I like start the day like, oh, I have so many Zoom meetings. I hate these Zoom meetings. These Zoom meetings are awful. And then every Zoom meeting, I'm like, oh my God, I can't do another one. I can't do another one. This is the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
Or I can just show up to the Zoom meeting and be fully present and engaged during the Zoom
Yeah.
meeting. And that's going to be a completely different day, how I
Yeah.
experience that day.
Yeah. I think that's the beauty of it, right? Is that I guess for me as a person who's done a fair bit both in practice and in life is, it to me it's always been like we're gonna change the relationship you have with yourself and your life and all of the constituent parts that comprise each moment, which is fundamentally different than the traditional relapse prevention approach, which is like we're gonna find this very specific context and build a skill around it, right? And then like when each time it like changes a little bit. We're like, oh, we'll adapt, right? Whereas this one's more about like changing the processes that govern how you show up in each of these individual spaces, so that when you show up there, you understand, like if we take it all the way back to that person who was like, what if I just want to, right? Like, I always talk to my clients about like, that's exactly what we're looking for here. We're looking for you to understand, like it's a choice. Each thing, every all around you, right? How we show up, we choose how we show up, we choose how we engage with our thoughts and our feelings, right? And I think there's some really great language in MBRP, which about like these visitors come into your space and you can treat them and deal with them however you choose to, right? But like that's it, right? We're creating a structure and a relationship around choice and how you show up and the relationship you have with the parts of your life that just makes it from an implementation standpoint, just like all it, right? It just like it's baked in the cake now, right? Whereas before we're like, oh, we're gonna put some sprinkles on top, right? We're gonna do this, we're gonna change it up, right? And then this one, it's in the core ingredients that you can't separate it from, which makes it just easier when you show up to one of these situations, right? Now you're just gonna be mindful, You're going to be here. I'm going to observe what's going on with me. I'm going to understand what drives my behavior. I'm going to understand what makes this situation nourishing, what I'm longing for potentially, right? Oh, human connection. That doesn't require a drink. Historically, I've had used drinks to make connection, but now it's one of many choices that exist once I understand its function, right? And allowing yourself to slow it down. We live in a society where everything's so fast and automatized that, like, if we just slow it down and understand, these processes, it just really makes these things, it just makes it different. That's why I tell people, like, it may not be better, but it's going to be different, right? And different a lot of times is better, right? And a bunch of times it isn't, and that's cool, right? And that's kind of the idea, is like, and being comfortable with that. And I always think people get comfort confused. I always do a thing where, like, I explain what it means. Like, the word comfort, actually, if you break it down into its pieces, the first part means with, and the second part means strength. It doesn't mean that you're going to, like, love what's happening. It means you're going to deal with something with strength, which requires us to slow down and think about it, and to proceed mindfully. And so I really love that part, because it really, I think, it ties all the way back to, right, what kind of alerted you to, like, maybe there's some fault points in this, which is like, what if I just want to? You're like, well, I didn't really have a plan for that today, nor do I really know how to respond to that. Right, but this approach, I think, really allows us to swing all the way back to there, understand what's going on with that person, but also understand how to support people in ways that are just more consistent with the way they live their lives and what is important to them.
I completely agree. And I'll say too, it's also just put a star and a bow around the fact that it's also like changing a relationship with things that are good and nourishing
Yes.
and really showing up for them. Like, how often do we miss those things
Yeah.
in our life that are so wonderful and so sweet? And so they're small things, they're little things. I always use the first sip of a cup of coffee or a cup of tea in the morning, or the dreaming of a dog who's laying at your feet, right? Like the little paw things that they do, and or just, a cat rubbing up against you because they want attention, or another human just reaching out, and if you're hurting and someone just says, just make some human contact, or
Yeah.
and really showing up for those things, And this morning the sky here in Mexico, we got a bunch of snow, and so the mountain that I look at is covered with white snow, and the sky was this brilliant blue. And I took a moment to savor that and to enjoy that. And I could have missed it, right? I could have gone about
Yeah.
my day super busy and just walked by the window and not even paid attention. But to take a moment and really allow that to be fully nourishing and showing up for that too.
Yeah, there's kind of beauty in all kinds of things, and to stop and acknowledge it. Another one that I think is related to sort of that second scenario you mentioned is intentionality. I talk about with my patients about just the value of making intentional decision over being sort of pulled along. And if that's a decision that you make and you can stop and think through it, and you look at all the sides of it, and you say, I do want to do this, then you at least did something intentional.
Exactly.
You know that, and so I think that's there's lots of, I think, just beautiful little nuggets in this approach.
And I'll say too, we're using it in a harm reduction frame now too, and so we definitely bring in mindful drinking. We've done some work. Christine Vinci led a study, and we've actually published some research, qualitative research on mindful smoking. And it's really interesting to actually be fully present and aware for engaging in substance use and what happens when you fully show up for that too. And
This is a really important point.
diversity of opinions
Yeah.
on this, but
Yeah, for sure. Sure. Yeah. I mean, our work right now, I have a paper under review that shows that people who savor positive emotion more, they drink more, but have less problems as a result of their drinking, which is, like, just not how you think about it. Right. And so maybe they're using drinking, for instance, to help savor an emotion. Right. Like, right. Yeah. And yet those people go on later to have less problems as a result of their drinking, which I think is, part of this process here. So if we really zoom in on understanding these processes that are at play, it allows us to decouple the behavior from the parts they don't necessarily like the depleting parts, right? And then it what's left is maybe the nourishing part, right? And it depends on how we show up on that day, on that moment. And I think this is a really important point here.
And beautiful findings. Yeah, I think exactly that totally fits with what we see clinically. And we've had some clients mindfully drink and kind of hate it. And most
Sure.
of the mindful smoking, most of the reactions were pretty negative. Like, I don't like the way this tastes. I don't like the
Yeah.
feeling of burning. And with mindful drinking, like, I think there's definitely been more variability, but definitely people who are like, I really don't like the flavor of this. I don't like the way it makes me feel pretty quickly. Whereas, other people are like, wow, that was a better way of drinking. Like I really enjoy this drink and I showed up for it and I,
Yeah.
consumed it in a way that I was really paying attention to what I liked about it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just throwing them back mindlessly, right? And so I could see that being associated with fewer problems down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Katie, we really appreciate this discussion so much. We really fit a lot into this relapse prevention, the mindfulness-based relapse prevention and stuff. There was one little piece that we hadn't gotten to, and then maybe jump to the take homes if you have a few minutes left. But there has been this movement away from the phrase, and listeners may have heard us saying relapse or return to use, sometimes interchangeably throughout this episode. So can you talk to us a little bit about what's going on with that and why that shift is happening?
Absolutely. And I will say I have thought about like when do we change the name of this treatment? Because first of all, the goal is not relapse prevention. Right? Like the goal of the treatment is much different from that. And so, I mean, when do we change the treatment? So Sarah Bone and I have had many conversations about that. Or do we just keep it, because that's what it's called and it's familiar and people are, using it. Just never kind of use the name beyond having it be the name. So a couple of things. So first of all, we've done some research, both Steve Maisto and I, back in 2015, 2016, and then more recently Wilco Sliedrecht, as part of his dissertation, followed up on that research. And first of all, just showed that like the term relapse is used so many different ways. There's like 65 different ways that we found it being used. So it's being used in the literature to describe return to use, return to heavy use, return to any use. In most cases, there isn't necessarily even a return. Like if you look at some of the data from the combined study, to call it return to heavy drinking doesn't make any sense because people never stopped heavy drinking. And
Right.
so it, returning to what? They never achieved a different level of drinking. They're just consistently stably heavy drinking. And so I think there's pragmatically, it doesn't have a solid operational definition.
Yeah.
And so as a tool of language, right, we have language to help communicate understanding of things. And should this term, we use the title, should this term be abandoned? Because we're actually using the same term to communicate a lot of different things. And there's not a lot of consistency and how we're using it. So that's one real reason is just pragmatically I think Bill Miller had a paper years ago, a great paper on 50 ways to leave the wagon. And I would say similarly, there's 50 ways to define leaving the wagon currently,
Yeah.
because so many, there's just this proliferation of different uses of the term. So that's one. But I think a bigger issue is just the stigma of it. And, it really focuses everything around using and not using, and there's so much shame baked into our current treatment program still around returning to use or returning to even controlled use. And so I don't think it's a helpful term from the perspective of perpetuating shame and stigma around consumption. And as long as we're using the term, we're going to be perpetuating that stigma. And so what I've been doing in my papers ever since, and my students and postdocs and other trainees hate me for it, is I, scratch out every use of the term relapse. And then if they're reviewing, if it's part of the lit review and they're reviewing another study that used the term relapse, I say, go to that original study. What did they actually measure? And use that. Did they actually measure return to heavy drinking? Use that. Did they actually measure return to any use? Use that. Like, let's be concrete in what behavior was actually studied in that prior work. And then in the work we do, we're going to not use the term relapse at all. We're going to use the term of whatever behavior we're actually studying. So
Yeah.
if that's percent heavy drinking days or returning to heavy drinking as defined by. So yeah, I think, I don't like that it creates shame and stigma. And I think we need to get rid of anything in our field that causes shame and stigma because we have too much of that already. And then just pragmatically, I don't think it's well defined.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
it's just imprecise, right? Like it reduces things to non-specific factors that everybody is using idiosyncratically, right? It's
Yeah.
like when you hear John Kelly talk about, some of the stuff they did with substance abuse, similar factors, right? Like everybody meant something different, has no real meaning, right? It's been co-opted by all kinds of different forces over the years to mean a thousand different things, and just to simply specify it in this way. And there's terms relapse show up also in, other medical fields, which mean return to previous states of functioning, which would be more like symptoms than use, right? And yet nobody's talking about it like that a lot of the times when you hear it colloquially used in treatment centers or by policymakers or things like that. Most of the time they're talking about use, which also links, I think, to some of your work around, in your previous episode on a non-abstinent recovery and, a movement towards that. I think all of this is bound up in it, and this is the next logical step to move to that. It's just to be incredibly precise about what we're talking
Yeah.
about from a behavioral perspective, and to remove these like jargony terms that are both unhelpful and unclear.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we need
Yeah.
to do. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Katie. This has been awesome. We have stayed a little longer than we intended, so maybe lightning round summaries. Is that okay?
Yeah,
Do you have time to do
absolutely.
that? Okay.
Lightning
Great.
round.
We'll move to our take home messages here, right? Which are just
Thank
little,
you.
little sound bites for different, specific audience members who might be listening. And so, what do you think the take home message is for people who are interested in making a change to their substance use or maybe investigating recovery?
Find mindfulness-based relapse prevention in your community. It's
Yeah.
I think I think the take home would be, first of all, that you absolutely can have choice. And you absolutely can recover, and this is one way. And I think there's lots of tools online. We are currently running a nationwide telehealth study of mindfulness-based relapse prevention, so I'll plug for that, called the Thrive Study, thrivestudy.net. But also, I think there's Recovery Dharma is available on intherooms.com. And that's another similar approach, but absolutely that you have choice, you can recover, and you can live a beautiful life by showing up for that life, even when it's hard.
Yeah, love it. Take home for practitioners.
Learn mindfulness-based relapse prevention. Seriously, no, I think the biggest take home actually for practitioners is going to be a little bit more, if you're going to do this with clients, do it yourself. Experience what it's like to cry on the cushion. We always use that phrase that until you cry on the cushion, you can't expect someone to actually, you can't expect yourself to be able to lead people in this practice until you truly embrace what it's like to sit with the stress
Yeah.
and truly understand what it's like to sit with positive emotion and truly understand what it's like to observe your mind telling you horrible, awful things about yourself. Until you do that and really sit with it, I don't recommend you leading these groups. I don't like recommend you doing this work because I really think to stick, the mantra of this, from Eastern philosophies is to do the practices and see what happens. And I would say the same thing for practitioners is to do these practices yourself and see what happens. And then when you're leading someone, you're doing the practice yourself. And if you're not able to do that, then don't do this because the heart and soul of these practices is genuine connection. And you don't get genuine connection by reading a script, and you don't get genuine connection by memorizing something. You get genuine connection by really being there with someone who might be suffering and you're sitting with them too, and you're sitting in it, and you're sitting in that suffering and seeing what happens, you know, and being present for that and fully present for it. So practice meditation if you're gonna deliver this treatment.
What would you say to policymakers?
I think being open to these alternative ways of treating addiction is critical. And so many of the people we've helped over the years have really benefited from this treatment, especially when they've been through a lot of other treatments, and a lot of other treatments haven't worked for them. And what has worked is that this treatment is very different. And so being open to the possibility that there are other ways of treating addiction. And also, I think to some of the core messages of MBRP, that life, you know, and core messages of the Noble Truths, that life is suffering. And at some level, policymakers also need to embrace that we need to create ways of help supporting people in being in a space where they can, you know, sit with suffering. And so a lot of basic needs are not met. So I think, you know, focusing on basic needs, I think there's a lot of attention to like new novel, exciting therapies like psychedelics are getting a lot of attention, and brain stimulation is getting a lot of attention. And it's like, can we get people, you know, their basic needs fulfilled first?
Absolutely. What would your take homes be for underserved populations?
So, you know, what I love about this treatment, and we've done some research showing that it does seem to be more effective for people from historically disadvantaged and marginalized groups. And the reason I think, and we need to test this, is because we're not telling your experience. We're asking you to sit with what other experience you have happening. And that is so validating for people who have been underserved by our systems. And so validating for people who come from very different cultural value backgrounds, and we're not telling you how to live your life or how to experience anything. We're curious about your own experience. And so having curiosity about your experience is part of this treatment, whatever that experience is. And I think a lot of people from underserved and historically marginalized backgrounds are constantly coming up against treatments that are just telling them what to do and telling them how to change without really understanding where they're starting from. And so this treatment starts where you're at, you know, starts wherever you're at.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. The last question we always ask our guests is, you know, you've been just super successful in your career. And so, you know, what advice do you have for trainees out there who might be listening?
So many ideas, but first of all, you know, make connections with people around you. So mindfulness-based relapse prevention came out of our graduate school cohort. You know, Sarah Bowen and I were graduate students together, and we continue to work together to this day on this, and now have had the opportunity to train so many others. And those people that we had the fortune to train are now doing this work. And so I mentioned Corey Ruse already, but also Megan Kerouac is doing this work now. Mm-hmm. Carly Edwards, Ikella Moniz-Lewis is now training, and so really doing, you know, engaging with others and, you know, doing the work together, and collaboration is so key and has been so key to any success I've been fortunate to have. And then also, you know, I think one of my biggest regrets was waiting so long before I started my own personal practice, and so. You know, like I mentioned, I was team RP, team relapse prevention, and it took me a while. And it took seeing a lot of our data before I actually, you know, sat my first retreat and started meditating myself. And it really has been a game changer in my life. And so not that everyone should meditate, but I wish I had found it in grad school. And you know, throughout my career, I think it has really helped me be more grounded and to take roll with the punches of academia a little bit better than maybe I would have otherwise.
Great point. All right, Katie. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you again. And thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to talk to us about you know, this important work and all the work you and your groups are doing. helping us move the needle.
Thank you. Thank you both so
Thank you.
much. It was
Thank
great
you,
to be
Kit
here.
Lady.